Thanks to Dr. Shipp for your forward thinking of having this, which is also, as we've learned from Dr. King, retrospective sage reverence, if you will. So I also like to thank my esteemed colleagues for doing a great job of setting up the whole topic, and I hope I'll try to bring it home here for us at the end by going with George's great example of trying to use an example to say, what can we do about this? Because I mean, Peter, you tried to end on a little positive note, but it is an overwhelming topic. So we think about One Health, but when we think about antimicrobial resistance and emerging infectious diseases, it certainly can be a downer, if you will. And so at this time, I think we can look to some really positive things, and we started hearing about some of the findings. But I'd like to talk to you today about an example of putting One Health into action and actually working together. I think the old school One Health, we still had the concept that human, animal, and environmental health were linked and important to be looked at together, but we sort of looked at them in our own disciplines. And I think the big change now, what's making this an exciting time for how we're practicing health, is that we are really starting to break down the silos and do this work together. So I'm going to talk to you about a project called PREDICT. It is not an acronym, even though it is all caps. You can blame USAID for that. But it is a project of the Pandemic Influenza and Other Emerging Threats Program. And I want to talk to you about it because I think it's where we're starting to put our money where our mouth is to really say, yes, we can do a better job if we work together and try to look across disciplines, across geographic boundaries to practice One Health. And while, you know, the disclaimer is there, I think this can happen, and you can think about it all the way down to the household level. This is a household friend of mine in Tanzania, one of the places that we're working on the PREDICT project. And these folks live a different kind of lifestyle than we live here in the U.S. They live a very One Health lifestyle. They think about their livestock being depredated by lions, and they also think about protecting and loving their cows as their pets while also getting nourishment from them. They also get diseases. This is my friend Mze Selendu, head of the Pastoralist Association there, and he died of tuberculosis, probably because he was drinking the milk right out of the cow. And so behavior change is a hard thing to do. Even when we know that we should do things in a different way, it's hard to be motivated to change hundreds or thousands of years of behavior. And so we can do as much as we can from a health perspective and a science perspective, but it's a tough challenge. The challenge that we were given, Peter and I and a consortium of folks around the world were given from USAID, was try to preempt or combat the first stages of emergence of zoonotic disease that pose a significant threat to animals and people, especially public health. So really what they said is, we want to bring you guys together and you show us that One Health can stop all the rest of the pandemic. And certainly that was, you didn't laugh, I laughed. It's certainly a haughty goal, and we're doing our best to just chip away at the edges of that. They helped us out by giving us enough money to make a go of it, so about a $75 million project over 5 years. But when you think about the globe and all of those undiscovered pathogens that Peter mentioned, that's not very much money to really make a dent in this problem, especially when we look at that emerging infectious diseases are really zoonotic diseases when we think about it, and where the majority of them are, and that human activity, so we talked a lot, and Lonnie talked a lot about that, but human activities that interfaces with animals are also linked to EIDs. So it's not just that they come from animals, but as Peter mentioned, it's how we are interacting with animals and how that's changing that is helping to drive our interactions and links and transmission opportunities. And so we really need new scientific approaches that are likely to reduce risk or improve responses to EIDs. I don't know, Lonnie, your kid holding the lamb might be cuter than my kid, but that's a calf. Calves are cute. All right, so I think it illustrates, though, that these people are living in close contact. People around the world are living in close contact. They aren't going to the grocery store and buying their meat, okay? And so the majority of the world, that's how this is how the interaction with people between people and animals is really quite intimate. And when we look at that, we have to think about not only what's causing people to be interacting with animals, but also what's causing things to change on the globe. And so land use change is a huge driver, potentially, of emerging infectious diseases, as is climate variability. And we're starting to be able to document that. We saw some great examples of that today. Markets and trade, migration and conflict, and resource extraction. Also water and food security, and how that makes us cut corners and maybe not boil our water or treat it as we should, and then the global transportation issue. So if we try to pull all of that into the big picture and say, how are we going to find the next emerging infectious disease? How are we going to stop the next pandemic? It sort of still boggles the mind. How do we get our hands around this? And so what we started to do is start with what we know. And so as Peter mentioned, we started with the modeling and looking at where emerging infectious diseases have come from in the last few decades. And you know, the best predictor is the past. And so we start looking at that. We also need to look not only at where things have come, but what were happening in those areas when they came. And also what pathogens, which ones are really showing up, and as Lonnie mentioned, those RNA viruses really seem to be the ones that are scientifically most likely to jump and then spread most rapidly. So we picked, together with USAID's guidance, which has some political influences within it, countries around the world in those hot spots that Peter mentioned. And so these are the countries, the 20 countries where we're active for PREDICT, and this is a consortium, as I mentioned. So I'm from UC Davis, and we manage some of the countries. EcoHealth Alliance that Peter runs manages some of the countries, as does Wildlife Conservation Society, Metabiota in San Francisco. So we brought together all of the folks, including Smithsonian Institution, that were really working in these countries around the world and working at these interfaces to try and get a jump on what we could do in a short period of time. And all of our programs involve a lot of partners in the country. So all of them are administered in the country by people from the country and working with the ministries. We work with 59 ministries in these 20 countries. And so this is really the big issue. So we talked about how diseases might be passing around in wildlife, but as you would think about it, wildlife, if they are a good reservoir, are unlikely to be getting sick. So the virus may be in them, but it's probably not a pathogen to them. And then it can spill over, possibly to other wildlife species, as we were talking about SARS. Perhaps it's going from the bat to the civet. The civet may or may not be sick, but we're starting to see a really different prevalence and a whole different pattern in that species that might indicate that it's not the reservoir, but it's a transmission host. And then we see the spillover to the people or to domestic animals. And so what we might see the amplification in domestic animals and then the spillover to people. And by the time we find out what is going on with this new pathogen, it may be that the epidemic, or heavens prevent, the pandemic is already too far along for us to be able to do much good. That's what happened in our very first experience in the PREDICT project. So right after we started, we're just getting our sort of scoping together, figuring out how we're going to look for these new pathogens and try to stop them. We were immediately faced with the situation, well, you guys are the experts, so help us respond. So we started working with CDC, WHO, Doctors Without Borders, as well as the animal side, FAO, the veterinary schools, the agricultural ministries in countries. And the very first outbreak that we dealt with in the very first year of the program was right in northern Uganda at the Sudan border, and we had a big mystery disease. And we were working with the Ministry of Health. The disease had apparently been going on for weeks before anyone knew about it, because this area was so remote, there was very little communication. The people were very much subsistence, living on those rats as we talked about before, with just a little bit of animal agriculture and almost no horticulture at all. And so the folks that were trying to address the situation did not have any equipment, any laboratories, anything that they could do really. So we were asked to come and assist, and we asked the Ministry of Health, you know, how's it going out there? And they said, well, we went out there. We couldn't find it. The road ended. We didn't find the village. Okay, so that's the first point. I mean, people don't even know where these folks are. And so it was weeks into the situation before tests were even being run. And then months into the situation where tests were being run, but as you can imagine, what can we test for? We can test for knowns. We don't have diagnostic tests for unknowns. We do have some very expensive research applications that we're doing a little bit on the diagnostic side in places like Europe and the US, but it's not in general practice in other countries. So it wasn't really until this samples from this outbreak were exported to the CDC in the US and they were run on pyrosequencing or deep sequencing that yellow fever was discovered. Now, Uganda has a whole research institute that was developed for yellow fever, but yellow fever hadn't been seen in Uganda for almost 40 years, so there was not a physician left who had seen yellow fever in Uganda that was still practicing. Their samples, when they were sent to labs and yellow fever was attempted to be run, no one knew how to run the test anymore. Okay, so it's not just the unknown mystery diseases that we need to improve diagnostics for, it's the undiagnosed diseases that may be known because we don't put it on our differential list anymore. So there is a big issue here that needs to be addressed everywhere in the globe. And so what we want to do is we want to move this curve so that we're really knowing and forecasting what's going on early. We know what's out there. We know what viruses are circulating in hosts and transmission hosts, both susceptibles and reservoirs, so that we can pick them up early. So we can pick them up early if we know what's out there because we can make tests. But if we find thousands to millions of viruses, it will be hard to make diagnostic tests specific for each one. So we can get better at diagnosing unknown things. Right now, those applications are pretty expensive. We're going to talk about a new way that we're trying to do that. If we do that, we can pick these things up earlier in domestic animals and people and hopefully narrow that red part where we're not responding and we're not taking care of the outbreak so that we have control benefits. And this is really why USAID wanted to get behind this project. They were tired of paying for lots of vaccine and throwing it out there, just like in that yellow fever outbreak. What happened? Folks from all over the world brought yellow fever vaccine, brought people on bikes with coolers, riding around in northern Uganda to vaccinate people for yellow fever after the outbreak was over. It's a Band-Aid, and certainly in public health, we want to make the community feel safer. But if it's not useful because it's over, we need to do a better job. So with PREDICT, we're working on using modeling. As Peter talked about, several of the projects he talked about are things we're doing within the PREDICT project, and Peter's team leads the modeling part of our project. Just like I mentioned, the consortium has different countries in the portfolio. Different partners also work together across the disciplines, but they do run different modes, and so Peter's in charge of the modeling team, so you saw a lot of that, so I'm not gonna spend a huge amount of time on that. Then we get out in the field and do intensive field studies. Now that may be at outbreaks, as I mentioned, but it's also looking in those hot interfaces where we think that there is intimate contact, there is land use change happening that might be driving a change in contact, and then we get into the laboratory to do investigations. But we need to do that in the country. Otherwise, we're not doing any good because if we keep just exporting, like I said, it takes weeks to months to get things exported and diagnosed out of the country. And so we look at the hotspot map that you saw before, and we continue to improve it. This is the subset that's looking at zoonotic emerging infectious diseases. And we take that down to a country level. So the hotspot map is very good for looking broadly across the globe. But when we go to a place like Nepal, and almost the whole country is red, how do we know where to attack this situation? We have to get on the ground and think about interfaces. So we start to work with our Nepalese partners and employees and colleagues, and we start to map out all the little symbols you see are trade routes, interfaces where people are interacting with animals and people, all the other interfaces that we can possibly predict are going on or document that are going on so that we know where to look. And that takes us places like this. Where is this? This is Kathmandu, the capital city, the biggest city, the highest influx of those jetliners, the new vector for emerging infectious diseases. And so when we look at these interfaces where there are new things happening, the political systems are changing, so pigs that never used to be a product that was really eaten very much in Nepal, they're coming into the city. And they're just treated as husbandry animals. If you've been to Kathmandu, you know that they can't kill cows because of sacred issues. They can't kill monkeys, again, because of sacred issues. There are cows, there are monkeys, now there are pigs. There are wildlife walking all throughout Kathmandu and mixing. And so this is the kind of interface where we are looking in this, and this is right in the urban slums where people have less access to health care, less access to education, making the perfect storm for emerging infectious diseases. And so as Peter mentioned, we use that modeling not only to target those interfaces and those locations, but the right species, and he's already explained to you why we're looking at the primates, bats, and rodents most specifically. But once we do that, we have to have some place to take them. So with PREDICT, we've been working on developing laboratory capacity as well in these countries. And so in our 20 countries, we've been working with 33 labs. We have 30 labs now up and running, consensus PCR. So some of the labs are, they know about deep sequencing or real-time PCR, and they want to do the most sophisticated technique. Everybody wants to jump to what's the world doing, what's the most sophisticated technique. But I'll tell you, the most sophisticated technique, like to look for H7N9 new flu virus, what does that do? That costs you a lot of money to run a test for one virus. And we said, wouldn't it be better in this situation if we learned a way to pick up all the viruses when we take samples and when we have sick people and we don't know what's going on with them? So we've gone to viral family PCR instead. And so we've gone back to the future, if you will, and we're using conventional cheap PCR, easy to train in. And the only downside is that you don't get an answer the day that you're doing it. You have to send out your product for sequencing. But right now that costs about $5 and takes about 2 days. So this is still very, very much quicker than the Uganda example of weeks to months to get a diagnosis. And what we've done is we've picked priority viral families where we think we might have epidemic and pandemic potential. And this slide actually says that we have 20 PCR protocols, but we're really up to about 32 PCR protocols that we're running in these countries, as well as doing joint capacity building back here, where we're checking QA, QC, and helping to optimize the methods. But to do that, as you can imagine, we don't have controls like for filoviruses. Nobody wants to take Ebola virus, live Ebola virus, into these laboratories and have a safety issue or a biosecurity issue. And so we've created control material, synthetic control material, so we've been able to both give these laboratories the ability to have known positives but without infectious potential, and we have it tagged synthetically with a little PREDICT label so that if there's contamination, we can pick it up so we know that they have false positives from contamination, which allows us to go back and help improve the capacity in the laboratory again. Once we know what we have, we need to share that information. So PREDICT has been going for about 4 years now. As I mentioned, because of that consortium approach and having people and partners on the ground, we're able to jump in really quickly and work in all these countries, I think, very efficiently. In just 4 years, we've been able to sample 45,000 animals in these 20 countries, and we've run about 200,000 diagnostic tests already in these countries, and that's just the beginning of our backlog. We're trying to catch up and get all these things because we had to bring labs on board and make sure that they were doing well. Now we're at the place to push that information out. And when we find a new virus, like we find a scary one, like we've discovered a new rhabdovirus that was killing people in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we of course get that right out onto GenBank, and we get it right out into publication. But when we discover hundreds of viruses, which we have, we start to try and do interpretation and do some risk analysis and figure out which ones we think need further characterization. But we do have a health map interface that will be pushing out in the next month all of our surveillance data so that the general public can see where we've been doing our testing. And soon, the viral results will show up there as well. In addition, we're pushing the viruses out into GenBank, as I mentioned, but we do have to get permission from all the host governments to release that information prior to it going out. And they've all agreed in concept to the public access, but sometimes in some countries that's a little slower than others. So our interface, actually HealthMap, has changed. Just if you follow HealthMap in the last couple of months, it looks a little different now. But this is the HealthMap Predict site where we can show you the different dots of where we're working. The underlying colors are that hotspot map. So look for that in the future. Also, in just these first 4 years, we've already had about 45 publications in the peer-reviewed literature that are supported by PREDICT, partially or fully supported by PREDICT, some with other partners. So our iterative strategy is to target those key interfaces using modeling to help us do it as efficiently and tightly as possible. Then we get the pathogen diagnostics and discovery going, and the informatics and reporting. And that's improving our outbreak situation. And now in Uganda, instead of weeks to months to get out to do these kinds of outbreaks, we have actually ecological team on a national zoonoses response task force that goes into place within hours of cases of mystery diseases being diagnosed, or not even diagnosed, just reported. And so we've gone from this weeks to months situation to hours, where actually we have preemptive plans already in place to do effective outbreak investigation. And as I mentioned, we've trained about more than 2,000 people from 59 ministries, and we've discovered more than 250 novel viruses in just 4 years. We've documented human pathogens in wildlife, killing wildlife, some of them endangered species, and we've documented animal origin and new pathogens that we think to be of animal origins in people. And not to be outdone on the Halloween imagery, bats are beautiful, but don't eat them.